Okay. Got your rambling boots on. Some of you are joining today. I'm not going to be able to sort of catch you up completely. I'll do a quick recapitulation of what we've done over the last 2 days, but I hope you'll get something from what we do today that we've been building up. So you may not connect completely. I hope you'll get something. Anyway, can you turn your global positioning systems off? Whatever they call them. Is that right? System? Yeah. Otherwise known as mobile phones. I like to ramble blind. So just to show you the route so far, we're talking about Vedana, which is the hedonic tinge to experience. Every experiencing moment has a tinge of pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain. That tinge, that experience, that hedonic experience, is a result. It's not a cause, as it were. You don't make it immediately. You don't choose it immediately. It's the result of actions performed in the past, although some of those actions may be very immediate. If you take a hammer and bang your thumb, the relationship between karma and vipaka is pretty close. But some things you'll experience that come from childhood, maybe even further back, Buddhists would say. So Vedana is a resultant of vipaka, a fruit, not an action. It's something that happens to you, not something that you do. We looked a little bit at the ethical consequences of that. You're not ethically responsible now for how you feel in terms of pleasure, pain, or neither. You may be from the past, but not now. So yes, Vedana has three categories. Of course, each of those categories includes a vast range of different experiences. But there's painful Vedana, dukkha. There's pleasant dukkha or happiness, sukha. And there's neither one nor the other, upekkha, in the Pali, upeksha in Sanskrit, which is a more complex term. It varies from a dullness, or it varies from anesthesia, you could say, not feeling anything at all, through to a sort of numbness, through to dullness, through to a very, very pleasurable, oddly, experience of detachment and non-reactivity. So these are the three primary categories of Vedana. Then Vedana is experienced on the physical plane in terms of immediate sensation. You hit yourself and it hurts. You stroke yourself and it's, well, exaggerated somewhat, it's quite pleasurable, etc. When the other senses come into play, for instance, the eye sense comes into play, it sees forms, and through the interaction of the mind, it discriminates those as pleasant and painful, whereas the sense of touch delivers immediate pleasure and pain. You see what I mean? And of course that gets more and more complex, can get more and more complex. So interpretation substantially determines whether something seen is pleasurable or painful. And then the important distinction that we brought in yesterday between in Pali, Samisa and Niramisa Vedana. Samisa means meaty, and Niramisa means unmeaty. But never mind the etymology. What they refer to is those feelings, in the case of Samisa, that are connected with pre-existing underlying tendencies to craving, hatred, and unawareness, ignorance. So the feelings themselves are, in a sense, neutral. They're ethically neutral. But through habit, they've become closely connected with patterns of reaction. Patterns of reaction that lead to new pain. So they're connected with cyclic motivations, for those of you who are familiar with the idea of the wheel of life. It's very important to get this clear, that the feeling itself is neither good or bad. It's not itself motivational, but it's become so closely connected in your mind with a particular pattern of reactivity that it's almost instantaneous. You know, the most graphic illustration of that is with addiction. So that the glass of wine or whatever it is, methylated spirits or whatever, is so closely connected in your mind with the idea of the pleasures that are the image is so closely connected with pleasure, and that pleasure is so closely connected with a craving that you don't notice. To see the bottle is to reach for it. You don't notice the flow, the interpretation, the connection with pleasure, and the movement to craving. So that it's what we call anusaya, which means underlying tendencies. Those underlying tendencies are specific to the individual and so forth, but they're also deeply ingrained in what it is to be human. Patterns of greed and hatred and unawareness are deeply embedded in us, and then we Buddhists would say that this has happened as the result of our habits formed in beginningless time. We've been doing this for lifetimes, Buddhists would say. So there's a very deeply ingrained underlying tendency which forms specific patterns that are ours in particular. But the Vedana, the samisa of Vedana, is so closely connected with these underlying tendencies, it is almost the same thing. And of course, part of our job, our spiritual task, is to distinguish the two, so that we're able to detach the feeling from the immediate onset of craving or hatred or just blocking off. On the other hand, niramisa vedana, are those feelings, those hedonically tinged feelings, whether pleasant, painful or neither, that easily generate in us motivation for the path. They easily stimulate faith in us. They easily stimulate inspiration. They easily stimulate maitri and so on, metta and so on. So to take an easy example, which may work for some of you, you see the Buddha image and immediately a sense of faith comes into your mind. The image is pleasurable to you because it's connected with the idea of growth, if you see what I mean. And the more pleasing it is aesthetically, in other words, the more harmoniously it's made, the more it represents a state of transcendence, or at least a state of peace, the more it will appeal to you, as we say, and then generate these responses. So it's a very, very important distinction. It's really the core of what I'm wanting to talk about. Learning to notice clearly the feelings as they arise, and without any guilt, without any shame, without any blame, accept them, and to separate out the reactions that come. In the first place, probably the main thing to do is to notice those that lead you into further patterns of pain, of cyclic reaction, and those that lead you to go forward on the path. So I'm going to talk quite a bit more about that. But this is where we've come from yesterday. So we moved on to the hedonic calculus, which is a rather nice term, which is also a hierarchy of pleasure. In this case, it's an inverted hierarchy of pleasure. In other words, it gets more pleasurable as you go down. Usually you present hierarchies the other way up, but this was has no significance, it's just the way I drew it. So we've got here three columns, sukha, which means pleasure moving into happiness, upekkha, which means neutral moving ultimately towards a sense of freedom and detachment, and dukkha, which is pain, happiness. What's the other thing? Unhappiness, sorrow, sadness. So we're looking at them on four different levels. We're looking at them in terms of physical sensation, in terms of mental sensation, in terms of aesthetic or mystical sensation, and in terms of transcendental sensation. So we've got only as far as mental sensation yesterday, so I'll just recapitulate that and then take us a bit further. So physical sensation, physical vedana, is represented under the heading of sukha by immediate sensation, pleasurable sensation. You know, the tongue, for instance, is quite direct. You know, a sweetness on the tongue is immediately pleasurable. Pleasurable skin contact is immediately pleasurable. You don't have to think about it. It's just immediately there. Neutral physical sensation is simply when there is no stimulation. The organs of sense are not stimulated in any way. And actually, probably it's very, very rare that there's no stimulation at all. In most situations, there's a mild element of comfort or discomfort, for instance. You know, even you know, you're not attending particularly to your body, but probably there's either a sense of ease or a sense of slight discomfort or whatever. So it's a low physical stimulus. Dukkha is actual physical pain, bodily pain, especially as delivered by the sense of touch, the immediate touch sense, which is in a sense the most uncomplicated. It's the least worked up. It just delivers you immediate sensations of pleasure or pain, in this case of pain. The other senses get more complicated, and the pleasures or pains can be more malleable. We've dealt with this a bit. So then, mental sensations, under the heading of sukha, what we're talking about at this level, because don't forget this is a hierarchy, at this level we're talking about happiness that results from an arrangement of circumstances that you desire. A set of conditions that have come about, that have arranged themselves, so to speak, or you've arranged, that you want, that you've wanted. So you feel satisfied, you feel happy because things are as you wish them. What can I think of that's nice and innocent? He or she finally says yes, or whatever. There you are, you can take that how you like it. The happiness then gets a bit more complex because there's anticipatory happiness and there's happiness of memory. But those are a bit more complex because immediately there's a little bit of pain connected with them, because happiness of anticipation is caught up with a little bit of longing, because you want it now. Even though you know you've got the pleasure, ooh, it's coming. At the same time, it's not here now. So there's a slight sense of sort of dis-ease. But at the same time, that's offset because you know you're going to get that set of circumstances. I think this is a particularly interesting issue. I won't go into it much now. It's something I've sort of investigated quite a bit in myself. That often what one does is put up with a measure of dis-ease now because of anticipated pleasure in the future. And because you don't properly make aware the nature of that craving, you've just associated it with pleasure and you've missed the fact there's an underlying dissatisfaction. So I think we can do things we really don't want to do, that we really don't enjoy, because we've got the idea of compensation later. I think compensation culture is something really to sort of look at in oneself. As I said yesterday, having been to a boarding school, I know all about compensation culture. You can think about that on your own. So happiness, the sort of most characteristic kind of mental happiness, is the moment when you get what you want. But it's also the sense that you're going to get it, and the feeling that you've had it in the past. So sometimes you can get some pleasure or some happiness from recalling past happiness. But again, there's a subtle sense of regret. It's nostalgia would be the most acute form of it, where you're sort of recalling old happiness, old pleasure, and you get some sort of little smile comes on your face. There's a tear in your eye at the same time. You can even feel that sometimes. There's a definite sort of sense like that. It leads to sentimentality and all sorts of glooky things like that. So yes, that's a mental sensation, that the kind of the purest form of mental sukha is where you've just arrived at what you longed for. In the middle is a state of lack of stimulation. And we talked quite a bit about that yesterday, and I think quite importantly talked about that as actually a sort of dulling of your life energy, you could say. That you're not living vividly enough to feel anything in particular. Or you're living a life that's so dull that you don't really know what you feel. You don't feel anything very much. And as I was saying yesterday, it's often connected with the search for very strong pleasurable sensation in compensation, either through drink or drugs or through very loud, intense music or intense sensory stimulation, because you've become dull and therefore don't really feel anything. And one thing we're going to find as we go on more and more is that you need some pleasure. It's difficult as a human being to really function effectively without some measure of pleasure. That's perhaps one of the most important things behind what we're talking about. And then sadness or unhappiness is where, in its primary form, where you're deprived of what you want, or you're getting what you don't want. You know it. What you don't want is there in front of you. What you do want is not there. And of course it's also becomes anticipatory, that you fear that you're going to get what you don't want, or that what you want is going to go. So it's also tied up with insecurity, anxiety, and so on. So there you are, mental sensation. And it's all based upon a coming together of a set of external conditions that give you the longed for moment or bring you the dreaded moment. But it's to do with the set of conditions. And we put a lot of energy into creating the conditions that will avoid unhappiness and bring us happiness by rearranging reality or trying to rearrange reality. And of course, as Buddhists, we know that this is a losing battle. You get it together for a while, but it slips away from you. And even when you've got it, there's an underlying dis-ease, which is the dis-ease of insecurity. Okay, so here we go on. Just pause a moment. Everybody reasonably clear? It's pretty clear, isn't it? I don't want to give you too much option because I want to move on. But just in case anybody's completely lost. Or if you're very, very lost. I won't even make a joke. So we're moving on to what I call the aesthetic or mystical. There must be other terms for it too. But I just wanted to have a headline, as it were. It's also perhaps you could say a sense of fulfillment. It's of course the pleasures of the path, you could say. So the pleasures of the path, there's also a neutrality of the path, or rather a new picture of the path, and there's a sadness of the path. All three are represented in the practice of spiritual life. We're going to start over with the dukkha side of it, because it's nicer to move towards pleasure, isn't it? There are very definitely pains involved with the practice of spiritual life. I'm very sorry to disappoint. Not my fault, I didn't invent it like that. And you could say, really, that there are three aspects to it. First of all, there's as you begin to really begin to apply yourself to spiritual practice and spiritual development, you have to face the consequences of your previous actions, which will be experienced often as pain. Not only, but often as pain. So whatever you've done in the past that is unresolved will emerge in your experience as a sensation of mental unhappiness or pain or sadness. So the first thing you need to do is to face up to the pain that is inherent in human existence. That's what it really comes down to. To be alive as a human being is to encounter pain. You can't avoid it. What we usually do is we try to stay one jump ahead of it. So we're always trying to palliate the pain, to, as it were, sort of wash it, wrap it in cotton wool of dullness or unawareness, or to compensate for it with pleasure. We try to stay ahead of it, by and large. But if you really want to practice spiritual life, you first of all have to face up to what is there. And part of what is there will be the pain that's inherent in existence. You can't avoid some bodily pain. You can't avoid things going wrong. And you can't avoid things emerging in your mind from the past that give you pain. As I said yesterday, I very strong experience of this when I spent a long time on my own. I did a long, long solitary retreat last year. Well, relatively long solitary retreat. I was alone for 5 months. And for a period of that, for about a month, I experienced an enormous amount I experienced quite a lot of remorse. You get loose proportion when you're on your own. You know, tiny pain becomes everything, and so on. But I experienced quite a lot of painful consciousness of things I'd done in the past. First of all, just embarrassment and those sort of things, and hurt, pride, all that sort of thing. So, and just the sheer consequences for my mind of things I've done in the past. So that's the first thing that happens in practicing the path, in moving onto the path. You will encounter a certain amount of dukkha as the result of what you've done in the past. You'll encounter a certain amount of dukkha just because you're human, just because you've got a body that's capable of experiencing pain. So it's something that you have to learn to accept and not run away from. So that doesn't mean that you can't do something about physical pain, for instance. It doesn't mean that you endure a physical pain unnecessarily. If you can remove it, you remove it. There are physical pains even. You just have to endure. There's quite a lot in the scriptures about enduring as an essential part of the spiritual life. For instance, you have to endure, the Buddha says, bite of mosquito. And that sort of thing. You have to endure the heat of the sun. You have to endure the lashing of the rain, especially if you live in Wales, as I do. So, you know, there are things that you just have to accept. And one of the things I've noticed while I'm in India is that Westerners, when they come to India, are constantly twitching to try to adjust pain out of it. Indians, you know, particularly the people, the Buddhists that we're involved with, who come from a very economically depressed strata of society, they just learn to put up with a certain amount of discomfort and pain. And they don't sort of think much of it. So they don't sort of constantly twitch. They adjust, as it said. I remember Bhante saying that he travelled with some people and they were not able to eat. In talking to them about this, they said, well, this often happens when we're travelling somewhere, we can't find anywhere to eat. And so Bhante had said something like, well, what do you do about it? And they said, we tighten our belts. But we're not accustomed to doing that. We put a lot of effort into adjusting the environment. And we've got a very highly adjusted environment. You know exactly what I mean, Krita. It's something one notices really glaringly when you come from India. I hope you haven't learned to twitch too much. Sometimes I think Indians put up with too much. But there's a certain amount that you just have to endure. And there's quite when you start to really take your mind on, you have to endure quite a lot that just results from your previous conditioning. You've got bad habits, bad mental habits, and those will cause you pain. And you can't immediately get rid of that. So that's the first thing, facing up to dukkha, that this is part of life, it's inevitable, and it will be coming to you both externally and internally. Secondly, there's dukkha, it's closely related to what I've talked about, but it's dukkha in the form of remorse, and this is what I mainly experienced on solitary retreat. It's odd, in Buddhism, remorse is a painful mental state that is skillful. It as it were, hurts you mentally, but it's productive of development. It takes you forward. So in the practicing the Buddha Dhamma, we learn to accept, even welcome remorse, and to resolve it by confession, by resolution, not to act in that way again, putting right what we've done, and so on. We have to be careful to do that, because there's an unskillful mental state that's closely connected with that, which is kokrutya. It's usually translated as anxiety. You know the hindrances, restlessness and anxiety. It's actually not really anxiety. Kokrutya means literally wrong done. So it's your awareness of something that's done wrong. But if you just stay with that awareness without resolving it, it becomes a hindrance. So as a hindrance to the mind, it's where you just wallow in it. You wallow in guilt. You wallow in regret, in nostalgia, and so forth and so on. And you don't bring it into full consciousness and resolve it. So there's a painful experience of remorse, which is highly positive. And one of the things I experienced on this solitary retreat was that the more fully you embrace remorse, your regret for what you've done, there's an immediate and powerful sense of happiness and forward movement. And I began to look for things that I'd done wrong so that I could experience remorse and then the release. I won't say I went around doing wrong things so I got it, but so that's the second form of the pain of the path. The third form is more subtle. It's not pain exactly. It's more like a niggle. It's really what I've called here incompleteness. The sense that it's not fully there yet. I think probably that the most immediate and clearest example is probably what you'd find with an artist. But you've painted a picture and you feel some satisfaction. You've expressed what you wanted to express. But you know that you haven't fully done so. So there's a sense of satisfaction, but not of of resting on your laurels, as it were. You know you can do better. You know you can go further. You know you can express a beauty or harmony or truthfulness much more fully and much more adequately. So it's a sense all the time that there's a slight bum note. You know, the piece is beautiful, but one note is slightly out of key. You get this very strongly in the Buddha's own presentation of his experience. He talks about his life in terms of a sort of movement. In some places he talks of his life in terms of a movement from one level to another. And what happens is he experienced life at home as cramped and unsatisfying. Even though it has pleasures, it has some of these pleasures, but it's cramped and dusty, as he put it. So he wanted more. So he went forth. He went forth into the jungle, and you know, enjoyed all the freedom that from responsibility and so forth that went with that. But what to do? There's a sense of boredom. There's a sense of incompleteness. So he sat down to meditate, concentrated his mind, experienced dhyana, first dhyana. So there's concentration, there's happiness, there's bliss, there's feelings of physical rapture going through his body, some thought in his mind, and he feels, that's all very well. But these thoughts, they're a bit sort of a nuisance. They're sort of slightly disturbing. They kind of mar the scene. So I thought, why don't I give them up? So he gives them up and moves on to the second dhyana, in which there's just happiness and rapture. But then he begins to find the physical sort of rapture a bit sort of too frothy, a bit overstimulated, a bit, what can one say? It's almost disturbing. So he wants to go on from it. Long for that state, eh? So he moves on to the third dhyana, but there's just happiness. But even that is still too sort of unbalanced, and he moves on to complete equanimity. But so his movement is presented in some of these suttas in terms of a recognition that there's something that's not satisfying. It's a very, very important consciousness to have. The consciousness that your present experience is not complete. Not in the sense that, you know, you could have a bigger mobile phone. No, that's not it, is it? A better mobile phone. Smaller mobile phone. Or a bigger hi-fi system or whatever. A P-phone. or whatever it is. You know, the latest, the better, the best. It's not that sort of unsatisfactoriness, because that's simply consumer unhappiness. The sense that there could be something, a happiness that's better. It's a definite sense that there's a fulfillment that's deeper or beyond what you're now experiencing. And it's sort of implicit in what you're now experiencing. You just need to sort of refine it a bit further, take it a bit further. So those are the three forms of I called aesthetic or mystical, the pains of the path. Simply facing up to the dukkha that's inherent in life. Accepting it fully, not hiding from it, not running away from it. Really taking it on the chin, so to speak. Not trying to adjust reality to suit your circumstances, which our whole culture is about. It's about adjusting to reality so that it becomes full of pleasure. Doesn't work, of course. Secondly, there's the pain of recognition of your own past unskillfulness and regret at that. Taken fully, accepted fully, and moved on into skillful action. The action of confession, of putting right, and of resolution. Resolution. And thirdly, the subtle sense of unsatisfactoriness, of incompleteness. It's not exactly pain. It's more like a slight niggle, or sometimes it can be a big niggle, but just a sense there's got to be something more. Take me in the right way there. That's good as it is, but it could be better. I often experience that in social situations. You're together, it's very pleasant, very cordial and so forth, but you sort of feel, well, there's more to be got from human society than this. We could be going deeper in our relations with each other, in our communication with each other. So it's not that you're saying it's all wrong or all bad or something like that, but it's just, there could be more from this situation. And the skill is to, in a social situation, is to bring that about without polarising or opposition or something like that. Well, even with a collective enterprise like the London Buddhist Centre, in a way that there needs to be always a sense that this could be better. Whilst it's very, very good, it could be better. This is the chairman's affliction. Even in your practical world, you have a sense that some greater meaning, some greater fulfilment could come into the situation, into existence, and in your own personal life and experience. It's what drives you on. I think that you can be driven on by a sort of magnetic attraction to the ultimate, to the real, to the Buddha, you could say. Or you can be sort of pushed on by a sense of this niggle in the present situation. And probably different people have different biases. Some are much more strongly drawn to the possibilities to the higher, as it were. And some are much more driven by a sense of the bum note in the present situation. But probably everybody will have something of both. And I think it's quite important to be very much alive to and cherish the feeling of incompleteness, of possibility, but not with discontent. It's odd. It's you can be perfectly contented, very happy, but at the same time have a sense that there's something more. I just got going through my mind. I don't know if anybody knows the oeuvre of Saint Tarkovsky. There's a wonderful film by him in which he quotes from a poem by his father, and the refrain of the poem is, all this is good, but there has to be more. So he's talking about the pleasures of family life, the pleasures of communication, the pleasures of beauty, but there has to be more. But not in a restless sense of looking for a different set of circumstances which are more pleasurable, in the sense of finding something deeper. So much for pain. Equanimity, that is the middle term, as it were, between pleasure and pain, on the path, in aesthetic or mystical equanimity, is a sense of equipoise, a sense of not being disturbed, a sense of peace, of ease. In a sense, you could say being removed from it or above it, but that could be misunderstood. You're not bothered by things. A bit like, well, I found this sometimes on my retreat, that I just look out the window. Sometimes it'd be sunny, sometimes it'd be raining. Quite often it'd be raining because it was Wales. Sometimes there'd be very, very strong winds, and in a best mood, as it were, I could just watch, and whatever it was, that's what it was. It was beautiful. It was what it was, and I felt quite sort of detached, at ease. And in a sense, it's a pleasurable state, but it's not pleasurable in the sense of as opposed to pain. A sense of just ease, contentment, peace. A very lovely feeling. And it's what we develop, of course, in the four Brahma Viharas as upeksha. Then there's the pleasure. element of it. And we could go on and on here. In the Abhidharma, which is the systematic psychological analysis of mental states in Buddhism, one particular system of psychology analyzes some, I can't remember the numbers now, but huge, and you know, a certain number, 100 and more mental states. 3 of those are painful, sort of 20 or 30 are neutral, and something like 60 or 70 are pleasurable. It vastly outnumber the pleasurable possibilities of the mind, vastly outnumber the painful, but we tend to hang around in the painful. So the most characteristic expression of the path in these terms is, some of you will be familiar with from the spiral path. There's first of all a sense of joy, pamoja, or pramodya. And this is the sense that the happiness that comes because you're living a life that's consonant with your own principles. Yeah, because you're living a life that is not discordant with what you really believe, what you really value. So everything you're doing is in conformity with your basic principles. So you feel very, very sort of satisfied and contented and joyful even. Not necessarily, you know, big grin on your face sort of joy, but just a quiet joy maybe. A sense that you're living out what's really important to you. That deepened becomes a strong release of pent-up energy. As you more and more put yourself behind what you believe in, energy is released. And even physical energy is released. Some people experience this particularly in meditation. You'll experience almost sort of orgasmic sensations passing through your body sometimes. You know, releases of tension in various parts of your body. And on a slightly more subtly mental plane. So there's a sense of more and more energy flowing into you. And sometimes even quite surprisingly, you know, some people get quite disturbed by it almost, because you can suddenly find there's rushes of energy passing through you. You see sometimes people, you know, when they're meditating, suddenly sort of twitch like that, as some sort of release of energy takes place, which is itself very pleasurable and leads to a stronger, deeper sense of happiness, pleasure. That eventually sort of calms down, but not because you know, you've got less happy, but because the sort of the pleasurable state, the happy state, has become more subtle, and all the energies have been integrated. A lot of what we do actually is to do with integration, isn't it? Where we're releasing energies that are locked up in the bifurcation or polyfurcation of our minds. And that the failure to recognize or experience the deeper dimensions of the mind. So piti or priti, rapture, is where all these disintegrated aspects are coming together. Prasaddhi is where they've sort of come together. And you're reasonably well integrated, both horizontally and vertically. And a very pleasurable sense of calmness. That passes over into sukha, which here means a kind of... an abiding happiness, which really, you know, even happiness doesn't quite do for it, but just a permanent sense of contentment, well-being, sort of contentment with yourself. It's sometimes said that along this path you experience what's called, the Pali is avipatisara, which means freedom from remorse. You could say it's a sense of innocence. You know that you're not causing harm. You know that in a broad way, at least, you're not doing anything wrong. You know that you're actually contributing, that you're doing something to help the world. And there's great satisfaction and pleasure from that. And all of that passes into a very strong sense of integration, which is known as samadhi, not just in the sense of meditation, but of very strong absorption. So I've just chosen this list, which is a classic list, to try and illustrate these sort of pleasurable states, these happy states that come to one as one experiences the path unfolding. Oh dear, the main thing I want to do. I'll have to come back. Anyway, then there's the transcendental dimension. Look, it's blank. Insofar as you've got a body, you're still going to feel that. But there's no mental unhappiness, because you don't want anything, so none of this sadness is there. You've got it all. This is complete, because you've accepted fully the pain that's inherent in life. You've completed, you've resolved all unskillfulness that you've performed in the past, and you have no sense of a restless longing for something further. So, that's an empty category here. You do stress, you do feel pain. If you're, you know, the Buddha, it says at the end of his life, experienced pain that was grievous, sharp and racking. But it did not disturb the core of his mind. So it's important not to pretend that the Buddha is without that, because a body means pain. He experiences an equanimity which is now completely unassailable. Nothing can disturb his equipoise. And that's described in terms especially of viraga, which means dispassion. So there's no turbulence in his mind. No longings are stimulated. Although he feels compassion, that compassion is not painful. And it's a quite important thing for us to get right. I think pity is where you feel distressed at the suffering of others, and you feel distress. But compassion is not represented by your own pain, as it were. What you do is you empathise with the pain of the other. But it doesn't affect you, because you've got you as you, so to speak, insofar as you can speak like that. So there's complete equanimity. And it said this, paramang sukha, in the Dhammapada, it says nibbana is the highest happiness, param sukha. What that is, I've no idea. I've yet to discover. I got some sort of glimpse of it from little bits of all of this, but it's something that goes completely beyond that, which is not, in a sense, not sort of located in a separate self. That's quite mysterious. But it's important to have this word there, even if we can't really quite give it any content, because otherwise what we think of is that Buddhahood is a state of absolute dullness, absolute numbness. But it isn't. It's a positive state of a kind that's beyond any sort of positivity that we can immediately know. We can have glimpses of it. We may even have very strong glimpses of it as we begin to experience more and more of the path. And you begin to experience prefigurations of it, early glimpses of it on the path. But the Buddha experiences it fully and finally. Rushing, because I want to give you the look at that. You could have done the hierarchy of pleasure of the path. Anyway, let's move on to the pleasures of the path, because there's some important content to this, some important practical content to this. What do we do about it? We need to be cultivating niramissa sukha vedana, and accepting niramissa dukkha vedana. So what do we do about that? If I'd had time, I'd have expatiated upon this more fully, but it really does involve looking at the way we live, looking at the context of our lives, even the lifestyle that we lead. Just to be provocative, at one point in the suttas, the Buddha talks of samissa sukha and dukkha as the pleasures and pains of the householder. I own a house, so I'm a householder too. And I know some of those pleasures and pains. But and then the niramisa, sukha and dukkha, are the pleasures and pains of the renunciant. So, you know, we can't exactly map the householder renunciant onto our lives because the context is so different in traditional societies, even in modern India. It's a much more meaningful distinction, but it doesn't really obtain quite in such a rigid way as it does in more traditional societies. Anyway, no time to go into that. But yes, there's a question of context and lifestyle, of building a lifestyle that gives you as much niramissa sukha and allows you to experience niramissa dukkha and upekka as much as possible, so that the path is stimulated for you. But before I go into this, I want to make a point, because it's a very important one, that Sangharakshita has made many times and that really underlies the approach of the Dhamma. He says, don't give up the lower pleasures until you are enjoying the higher. So if Buddhism is not a path of giving up pleasures before you've experienced something higher. Because what happens if you give up lower pleasures before you've experienced higher pleasures, there's a kickback. I've experienced this myself. If I tried celibacy and before I was ready for it. And there's a kickback. I won't tell you what the kickback was. But yeah, if you stultify the basic need for pleasures, even of a sensuous kind, you will get some reaction. So you need to have a sort of intelligent, sensitive movement from the lower to the higher, which I think needs to be quite conscious. I think this is something that we need to think about a great deal more in our collective lives. How do we build a life in which there's a definite movement towards the higher pleasures without any sort of moralism, any sort of puritanism, any conventionalism about the lower pleasures, to call it that, lower pleasures. So this is an extremely important principle that underlies the hedonic calculus. Would that I had another day to talk about it. So let me just rush through so that you've at least heard the words and we can come back to it later. I just made up a list quickly myself, but no doubt you could add things to it. So I think there are the pleasures, the niramissa pleasures that come from the environment. I think for a start, there's the pleasures of nature. I think that a close connection with the natural world satisfies quite basic pleasures, which are by and large niramissa, if you see what I mean. They don't lead to craving. They lead to a sense of fulfillment, a sense of openness, a sense even of transcendence. You know, it's all we're so familiar in this country from our culture with the Romantics, who experience so much of a sort of expansion of the mind from nature. And it's, of course, it's a key issue in the modern world, in the modern city. And then closely connected with that is the pleasures that come from aesthetically pleasing surroundings, making sure that the environment within you which you do live, even if it is not an immediately natural one, is pleasing. The colours are pleasant, the shapes are pleasant, there are inspiring images, there's a pleasing sense of harmony, even of order, although one man's order is another man's chaos. But yes, you need a certain amount of pleasure from the simple environment in which you live. Pleasant buildings, pleasingly put together, nice colours, harmonious, even decent, pleasant clothes. I'm not very good at this one. It all depends on the charity shops. And so on. So that you give yourself, without obsession, a reasonably pleasurable physical environment. Then there's the pleasures of society. So here, obviously, there's a contrast with social pleasures that are samisa, in which there's a strong attachment to others. That strong attachment to others leads you on the round. But there are social pleasures that are niramisa. In other words, the pleasures of friendship, the pleasures of sangha. So being with people who share your aspiration, who share your desire for expansion, for greater meaning and so on, and with whom you can communicate in a way that brings you great happiness and pleasure. So you need to move your social life more and more in that direction. There may be an attachment element in your life, but make sure there's another element there too. I think it's especially important because attachments often lead to breaking, which leads to pain. If you've got a strong niramisa, a social environment as well, you can move relatively easily out of that, the pain of attachment. Move into it again if you want, but make sure that these are alive, the friendship, the community, are very much alive for you. Because they bring you pleasure. As human beings, we need the pleasure of communication, the pleasure of shared affection and warmth, of pleasure of mutual support. Just the lovely happiness that comes from sitting around a table and feeling that everybody's in harmony and sort of likes each other and wants to help each other. That sort of thing that really can be so fulfilling. And you know how decent conversation can leave you feeling so uplifted and inspired, much more than all the entanglements and problems that go often with more complex attached relationships. The pleasure of art. I think that you could. I've threatened to do this. I'll just very briefly touch on it. But I think you could say there's an aesthetic criterion in this distinction between niramisa and samisa. I think that from a Buddhist point of view, art is that which brings you pleasures or pains that are opening you up, that bring greater meaning, greater beauty, greater understanding, greater pleasure of a higher open kind. I stress that it may be pain, because I think sometimes art faces you with the pain of life in a way that opens you up. So there's a lot to be said under that heading of art, but let me just sketch in a sort of fundamental aesthetic principle. The pleasure of meditation. I won't say more, the light is flashing. The pleasure of understanding. First of all, I think that the pleasure of the removal of doubt through clarification of the mind. I hope you're getting some pleasure from what I'm saying, because it clarifies your understanding of your own experience, and it does give some sense of pleasure. You feel a bit happier, a bit more clear, I hope. Don't all shout at once. The removal of doubt. Then there's the pleasure of understanding at a deeper level, which I would say was more imaginative, even symbolic, where there's not an intellectual understanding, but a coming together of the intellectual with the emotional. It's a total understanding, which in Buddhism ultimately becomes a vipassana, insight itself, but is prefigured by moments of clarification, which you may not even be able to put words to, were maybe mediated by a symbol. It's Atala territory. But were intensely pleasurable. When you get this sense of understanding at this level of coming together of symbol with feeling and thought. There's faith, the pleasure of faith, a strong sense of attraction to something that for you is undoubtedly higher or even highest. It's intensely joyful, pleasurable. And when you have that feeling, everything settles down. Your whole world comes into focus. And it's very, very joyful. The sense of veneration, being able to look up without reserve, without reservation. Very, very enjoyable, very motivating. Whether it's towards great beings like Buddha, or great Buddhist figures, or even very, very noble beings, people without any Buddhist sort of context, but who've lived good lives, who've led lives that are worthwhile, that are truthful, honest. You know, the wonderful when you see an act of real self-sacrifice, where somebody gives themselves for the sake of another. It's very deeply moving, and very, very inspiring. Very, well, pleasurable is quite the wrong term, but it induces a very positive, pleasant state of mind, a happy state of mind. Pleasure of commitment. The sense that you've worked out what you want to put your life into, and you're able to say that's where you want to go. Whether it's in an immediate sense or in a larger or deeper sense. And that leads into the pleasure, the happiness of skillful action, where you're living an ethical life, where all your actions are beneficial, none of them are causing harm. And especially, I think, a life where you have the sense that your actions are consonant with your ideals, with your aspirations. You feel that everything you do works out what you really believe in. There cannot be anything more wonderful than that, I think. Where you really feel that you're living the life that you should be living, that you're meant to live. In a way, it's almost like a calling. It may not be literally in sense of particular actions, but you have the sense this is what you're meant to be doing. And it's the most remarkable, most wonderful sense of fulfillment, which is, you know, another term, I suppose, for sukha. And the more you can feel that the richer your life will be. Deep sense of meaning, of purpose, of ability to overcome difficulty, and so on. I personally experience this most strongly working in India, just working amongst people who a little bit of Dhamma, smallest piece of Dhamma that I know, which is not any big cost to me to give, in it, being able to communicate that, people can change their lives utterly. And I cannot think of anything better for me to do, to have that sense that I'm living without any kind of, I can't be proud about it, it's not my Dhamma, it's the Buddha's Dhamma. And you know, what I'm giving is something quite simple, but it just has such a big effect. And that for me is emblematic of this sense of your life being consonant with your highest ideals. That, I think, is what we need to aspire to. We need to work to make our lives completely consonant with what we really believe and what life really seems to mean. And if we can do that, we're very much going to experience niramissa sukha vedana. Yes, the whole path will unfold in a very pleasing way. Not always easily. Dukkha will be there as well. But we'll be able to face that, be able to confront that and pass beyond it. So I hope that I've given you some greater understanding and clarity about Vedana and how to work with it. I'm really sorry that this is really another session, but at least there's a clue to where that might go, and there are some very gifted teachers here who might want to take it forward in their own way. I'm particularly interested in this one, the application of samissa and niramissa to art. I had a very good conversation with a Buddhist artist in Delhi who is really inspired by this notion, but I'd love to see others take this up. But I think the whole idea of a context or lifestyle that promotes niramissa, sukha, dukkha, and upeksha is very, very important for us and something really fruitful for us to explore further. So thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to ramble around something that's been very important for me quite recently. And sorry that the last phases of the ramble were more of a sprint.